Lecture 16, Translating the Bible into Modern Languages.
The Protestant Reformation of the 16th century, I have shown, created an unimaginable change in Europe. The Reformation, to begin with, was not one, but several things. Although the rejection of Catholicism was shared by all reformers, they did not agree with each other on any number of points, and the Reformation developed in quite different style within the Lutheran tradition, within the Reformed tradition, within the Anglican tradition, and broadly within also the Anabaptist tradition. So the Reformation was not one thing, but several things going on simultaneously. Nor did Catholicism, now Roman Catholicism, disappear. The Counter-Reformation, symbolized by the Council of Trent in 1545 to 1563, accomplished several very important things which made Catholicism a much more credible player in the religious arena of Europe. It accomplished a very significant and impressive moral reform. It began a program of better educating its clergy. And it began an aggressive program of opposing Protestantism on virtually every front, thus the name the Catholic Counter-Reformation. As a result, European history in the aftermath of the Reformation and Catholic Counter-Reformation lost any trace of its earlier social and religious unity. There are a number of features connected to this. First, the Constantinian premise that there should be a unity between church and state continued. You will remember the conviction of all ancient emperors that the people that prays together stays together, and that the main function of religion for emperors was to be a kind of glue for society. Thus, Diocletian, at the very beginning of the 4th century, sponsored Greco-Roman pagan religion and persecuted Christians. In 313, Constantine decided that he would become Christian, became the patron of Christianity, and made life difficult for pagans. In the 7th decade of the century, Julian the Apostate turned it around again and returned to paganism. And in 381, Theodosius I, in the blink of an eye, made the empire Christian again and pursued the oppression of paganism. So that principle was well in place. But now, increasingly, that premise of the unity of church and state was pushed in the direction of what has come to be called Erastianism, a political theory named after Thomas Erastus, a Swiss theologian whose dates are 1524 to 1583, that asserts the supremacy of the state over the church, even in ecclesiastical matters, so that the dictum, cuius regio, eius religio, roughly translated, the religion of the prince is the religion of the realm, held sway within Europe. And as a result, Europe, after the Reformation, became a checkerboard of Protestant and Catholic countries, with princes supporting one position and persecuting the others. Freedom of religion, in the sense of the American Bill of Rights, was simply unknown. If a European king converted from Protestantism to Catholicism, that king's realm had to follow suit. And so this was that politics and religion very much bound up together. So you had Catholicism in France, Italy, and Spain, which now had adopted the title of the Holy Roman Empire, and one form of Protestantism or another in Germany, Scandinavia, England, and in part of the Low Countries, with Belgium being Catholic and the Netherlands Protestant. This Constantinian principle of the unity of church and state was continued also in the militaristic spirit of the Crusades. Whereas the original Crusades had been an effort to rescue the Holy Land from the infidels in the name of Christ, now we find princes going on holy wars against each other, but both princes are operating in the name of Christ. And Europe enters into a period of ongoing wars between Protestant and Catholic nations. The case of the defeat of the Spanish Armada by England in 1588, or the 30 Years' War that involved so many European nations between the years 1618 and 1648. The scandal of these internecine conflicts is one of the factors I will mention later that gives rise to the Enlightenment in Europe. This competition between branches of Christianity also extends itself into world exploration. You remember that the 15th and 16th centuries was the age when new lands were being explored and discovered by European explorers. And this involved a quest for wealth, to be sure, but it also represented a kind of spiritual colonialism. So that Western colonial adventures and the expansion of Christianity went hand in hand. But this Christianity was now divided, so that territories conquered by Catholic Portugal and Spain turn out to be Catholic, as in Latin America, and countries conquered by Protestant Netherlands or England turn out to be Protestant territories. So this competition continues as a result of the Reformation. The sense of national identity was sharpened further by the development of modern European languages and literatures during this period. Latin, as I've suggested, continued to be the language of diplomacy and of scholars, but that represents a very thin slice of the entire world. And in increasingly, the development of modern European languages asserted itself in every realm of life. The Bible, in all of this, seems to be a unifying element, since every side is appealing to it, but is, in fact, part of the disunity and the experience of disunity. It reveals its intrinsic internal diversity because it enables virtually any position to be supported. Do you want to argue in favor of this theological position? The Bible will help you. Do you want to argue in terms of this theological position? The Bible can support that. So if you want to be a Reformed nation, then you read the letters of Paul. If you want to be a Catholic nation, then you read the letters of James. Both of you can claim to be perfectly scriptural in your position. So the inconsistencies, discrepancies, and contradictions within the biblical text, which had been there from the beginning, now became more apparent in this context of intra-Christian polemics. Furthermore, it made the issue of translation, which is really our topic for the day, all the more obviously critical. How words are translated can help support one theological position or another, one form of organizing the church or another. Should we translate the Greek word presbyter as priest or as elder? If we translate it as priest, we are obviously giving scriptural legitimation to one form of ecclesial arrangement, namely the episcopal. If we translate it as elder, we are giving scriptural legitimation to quite another form of ecclesial polity, namely the congregational form of polity, or Presbyterian. Should we, in fact, translate the Greek word ekklesia as church, and thus seem to be supporting the Catholic and Anglo-Catholic position? Or should we, equally legitimately, translate it as congregation, and thus give obvious support to congregational styles of meeting? translation can be used as a tool to legitimate political and especially ecclesial positions. Indeed, after the Reformation, even the differences in the composition of the Bible become ever more obvious. After the Reformation, it is possible to speak of four distinct collections that go by the name of the Bible. We've talked earlier in this course about the Jewish Bible, the Tanakh, which consists of 39 compositions in Hebrew, if each one is counted individually. The five books of Moses, Torah, the 21 books of the prophets, Nevi'im, and the 13 books of the writings, Ketuvim. So it had long been known that the Jewish collection was different than the Christian collection. But now we see, after the Reformation, differences in the Christian Bible. The Protestant Bible has 66 books. It retains the traditional 27 books of the New Testament, despite Luther's complaints about not keeping them, the disputed ones, with the others. But the Protestant tradition adopts the Hebrew canon for its Old Testament. This is very similar to what Jerome wanted to do when he translated the Vulgate, as we saw. And here we see the classic position of the Renaissance, the preference for the Hebrew original rather than the Latin translation that had been based also on the Greek translation. Now, the Vulgate and the Septuagint are reduced to the status of translations, no more important than any other. So the Protestants have the Hebrew canon, but they arrange it differently. For the Protestant Old Testament, we have the Pentateuch, five books, historical books, 12 books from Joshua through Esther, five wisdom books, and 17 books of the prophets. So it's the same canon as in the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, but they were arranged in different categories. The books that had come from the Septuagint are now referred to by Protestants as the Apocrypha. The term Apocrypha simply means not canonical. They are not to be read as Scripture, and either are not included in the printed Bible, or if they are included, they are usually included in a separate space. So typically, if one has a Protestant Bible that includes the Apocrypha, the sequence would be Old Testament, Apocrypha, New Testament, or Old Testament, New Testament, and then Old Testament Apocrypha as a kind of appendix. But their special status is indicated somehow through placement. Now, the Council of Trent, in its session of 1546, affirmed for the Catholic tradition the traditional canon that had been used all along, and it asserted the authority of the Vulgate translation for faith and morals. Let me spend a second clarifying this. Here we have an assertion within Catholicism of the Church's Bible and tradition over against what I have called the Scholar's Bible, which really came into play in Protestantism at this point. Furthermore, the authority of the Church's Bible, the Vulgate, was carefully delimited. It is authoritative not as a source of historical accuracy or as a source for natural science or for physics, but rather when it purports to speak to what does it mean to have faith in God and how one should live as a person who has faith in God. So faith and morals are actually a delimitation of the authority of the Vulgate text. In any case, the Catholic canon includes the 27 writings of the New Testament and the Old Testament canon that had been found in the Septuagint, which has 47 writings, making a total of 74 writings. The writings that the Protestants called apocryphal that had been in the Septuagint are termed now by Catholics deuterocanonical. Canonical in a second place, which represents a diminishment of status, to be sure. But in contrast to the practice in the Protestant Bible of putting the Apocrypha in a separate place, the Catholic deuterocanonical books are included under the separate categories of historical books, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, the wisdom books, the Wisdom of Solomon and Sirach, and the prophets, Baruch. In other words, for a Catholic reader, reading the Wisdom of Solomon, there would be no sense that this writing was different than the Book of Proverbs, or the Book of Job, or Koheleth, other wisdom writings. It was included in that same grouping. So although it is called deuterocanonical, the effect on the reader is that these writings are scripture in as full a sense as the properly canonical writings are. Finally, we have the largest canonical collection, which is maintained by the Eastern Orthodox tradition. This is a Bible of 77 writings, since it has the 27 writings of the New Testament, plus the 39 writings of the Hebrew Bible, plus 11 rather than 8 writings from the Septuagint. It includes 1st Esdras, 3rd Maccabees, and 4th Maccabees, which the Catholic canon does not. This is all fairly tedious, but the consequences are very real. After the Protestant Reformation in Europe, in some, whereas Jews and Christians clearly knew that they meant different things when they said the word Bible, Christians too needed to look carefully at who they were talking to before they made an argument on the basis of the Bible. For example, traditional Catholic teaching concerning the afterlife is very much supported by the Book of Wisdom. The souls of the righteous are in the hand of God, says the Wisdom of Solomon. For Catholics, this is entirely scriptural, and thus it is a real demonstration of the continuance of human existence after death. Protestants who wish to support that point, if they hold it scripturally, will not find it in their scripture. It's not in the canon of the Protestant Bible. Now, if translations, as I've suggested, could shape meaning, and if Bibles could be made available to everyone through printing, religious competition in Europe did not miss the chance to develop competing translations, competing versions, and with them, notes, which was now made much easier because of printing, annotations which supported their particular translation and their particular way of interpreting that translation. The Bible became the people's book as it was quickly translated into the developing modern European languages. But I am suggesting these translations were scarcely neutral. The most significant initiative was taken by Martin Luther himself. He translated the entire Bible into German. He translated the New Testament in 1522 in a period of only 3 months, and provided, as I've suggested, these highly tendentious introductions to the New Testament and to the individual books of the New Testament, which laid out his principles of interpretation. The Old Testament took much longer. He completed it in 1534. Now, there had been efforts before Luther to render the Bible into German, despite Episcopal resistance, but his was by far the most successful. It was, in fact, a labor of love. Scripture had always been close to the heart of Luther. He gave commentaries on Scripture when he was an Augustinian monk. He called himself a doctor of sacred Scripture. He weighted everything on the basis of Scripture. You will recall that the pivotal moment for Luther in his change from a scrupulous Augustinian monk who was tormented by guilt, to a robust reformer of the church, came in his famous tower experience, in which he quite literally experienced physical release at the same time that he was reading the letter to the Galatians. So it was by no mistake that he referred to the letter to the Galatians as his Katie von Boren. Katie von Boren was the wife whom Luther eventually married. And so he connected his personal liberation with the reading of St. Paul, and specifically the letter to the Galatians, which Luther read as prefiguring his own attack on Catholic works righteousness. Luther read Paul as, in fact, countering Jewish works righteousness. This is not exactly an accurate reading of Galatians, but nevertheless it was Luther's, and it was that important for him. So his undertaking of this translation was really a labor of love. And Philip Schaff, in his History of the Christian Church, says that Luther made the Bible the people's book in church, in school, and house. If he had done nothing else, he would be one of the greatest benefactors of the German-speaking race. For the New Testament, Luther used Erasmus's edition of the Greek. Remember, Erasmus came out with this Greek edition of the New Testament in 1516. And for the Old Testament, Luther used a Hebrew text that was prepared by associates. He leaned particularly heavily on his scholarly friend Philip Melanchthon. And for a period of years, Luther met every week with a Bible club of learned people who worked with him through passage after passage of the Hebrew text. Just as Jerome's translation of the Vulgate was brilliant because of Jerome's great facility in the Latin language and his ability to capture the nuances of Hebrew and Greek in Latin, so it was Luther's brilliance as a writer of German that gave his translation its particular character. He rendered the Bible in a fresh and simple High German that would shape Lutheran piety and the German language itself for centuries. Now, Luther was not afraid of much, and he certainly was not afraid to emphasize points of Reformation theology in his translation. Most famously, in Romans 3:28, where Paul says, "We hold that a person is not made righteous through works of law, but through faith," Luther added the German word allein, so that it reads, "We hold that humans are not made righteous with God through works of law, but only through faith." He understood what he was doing. He knew that he had inserted an interpolation into the text, which in fact made Romans support his own position of sola fide, faith alone. But he considered that this was necessary to bring out the real meaning of what Paul was saying. Luther continued to tinker at this translation and produced five new editions before his death in 1546. So successful was Luther's translation that the Catholics in Germany produced three rival translations in German between 1527 and 1537 with Catholic annotations that would counter Luther's interpretations. But they were not nearly successful, and they were using the Vulgate for their translation. And in fact, embarrassingly, they depended on Luther for many of their specific renderings, so that Luther complained in his table talk, "The papists steal my German, which they knew little of before, and they do not thank me for it, but rather use it against me." Translations of the Bible quickly appeared in other major European languages. Spanish translations had appeared already in the medieval period as early as 1280. Notable examples were the Bible of the Duke of Alba in 1430 and an Old Testament translation by Rabbi Solomon in 1420. The first complete Spanish Bible from the original languages was carried out in this period, the Biblia del Oso by Cassiodoro da Reina in 1569. The first printed translation of the Bible into French was by Jacques Lefebvre de Taple. His dates are 1450 to 1536. He was a French priest and a humanist, resembled Erasmus in many ways, a man of great learning, who criticized the abuses in the Catholic Church, but refused to break with the Church and wanted to seek reform from within. His translation of the Bible into French appeared in 1530, and then a Port-Royal version appeared in 1695, carried out by Antoine and Louis-Isaac Lemaître, and that won wide acceptance among both Catholics and French Huguenots. The term Huguenot, of course, refers to Protestants within the French language. In the Netherlands, the first translation into Dutch from the Hebrew and Greek was ordered by the Synod of Dordrecht in 1618 and appeared in 1637. And as a splendid example of the principle of cuius regio, eius religio, Gustav I Vasa converted Sweden to Protestantism and ordered the Bible to be translated into Swedish. Both among Protestants and Catholics, translations in other European languages cemented national identity and helped shape national literatures. The Bible was translated from the Vulgate into Czech in 1488, and then from the original languages between 1579 and 1593. The New Testament was translated into Finnish in 1548, and the whole Bible appeared in 1642. In Hungarian, the New Testament was printed in 1541, and the entire Bible in 1590. Finally, a Polish translation of the Bible came out between 1541 and 1597. As we shall see in the next two lectures, part of the same phenomenon of rapid translation was the process of Englishing the Bible. Now, the face of Europe that had in so many ways stayed much the same for so long was decisively changed in the matter not of centuries but of decades. And the Bible was part of this change. How shall we evaluate it? Positively, it can be said that the Bible was no longer remote from ordinary people. It was no longer read from on high, but it was close at hand and available to be read. It wasn't available only in a foreign language, but in one's own language. It was not interpreted by a person who was on a higher social scale than myself, but could be interpreted by my local pastor. And indeed, I could interpret it myself. All of these, it seems to me, are positive developments. But there were other aspects of this rapid proliferation of the Bible within a divided Christianity, which perhaps had less happy results. In some ways, the Bible was almost too familiar. Now, in reading alone, I encounter the inconsistencies, the contradictions in the Bible. The fact that the Bible was written by different times and different places, by different people, and had those inconsistencies from the beginning, was covered up for so long by the tradition of the church that tended to harmonize, and by the authority structure that made it all come out right. Now, when I encounter those difficulties and inconsistencies myself, I am put in a different kind of cognitive dissonance. I don't have another authority to turn to. So within Protestantism in particular, the Bible is supremely important, but it is no longer so obviously authoritative. The diversity of versions, of translations, even within the same neighborhood with Europeans living cheek by jowl, does not inspire confidence in the authority of the Bible. Rather, that pluralism, like all pluralisms, begins to make one question, are they both false? Are they both true? Or is one true and the other false? And so Christians enter into a situation in which there is not one Bible that speaks to all, but Protestant, Orthodox, and Catholic Bibles that not only divides but also reinforces the divisions within Christians. So that up to the ecumenical movement of the 20th century, Christians would make sure that they were reading the right version of the Bible. Are you reading a Protestant Bible or are you reading a Catholic Bible? Comfort could be found only in one's own version, for the version of somebody else, there could be only suspicion.